What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Larson, this is Houston.
Go ahead, Houston.
Abort mission. Repeat, mission abort.
Explorer, this is Kowalski confirming visual contact with debris. Debris is from a BSE sat. Repeat, I have
Dr. Stone requesting faster transport.
We have to go, we have to go, go, go.
We have to go, 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 all right. Our mission, count down the top films of 2013.
Not even space debris could stop this show.
Let's hope it doesn't come to that. Joining us for this two-part look back at the year in film, the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips and, from The Dissolve, Scott Tobias.
We'll also hear best of the year picks from a few special guests and play Massacre Theater. It's all ahead.
You have to learn to let go, Josh.
On Film Spotting.
Hello, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. This is Matt Singer from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast, and on the new SVU, Allison Wilmore and I pack our shorts in every color and our dark tanning oil as we head down to St. Pete for a review of Spring Breakers.
And inspired by Spring Breakers, we'll also take a look at the career of the film star, James Franco, and recommend some other titles featuring Franco available for instant streaming or rental. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us on iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
You're listening to Film Spotting. It is truly the most wonderful time of the year. Our pleasure, our pain, mostly our obligation. It's our best of 2013 show, which this year we're splitting into two parts.
Yeah, think of this week as Thor and then next week as Thor the Dark World.
Yeah, you completely read my mind there, Josh. Our special guests, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and Scott Tobias from The Dissolve. And guys, this has become an annual tradition. Michael, Scott, welcome in. Thank you.
Well, they keep making them.
That's true.
We have to keep seeing them.
Yep. They do. But I was looking back at the Film Spotting site. I believe, Michael, your first top 10 show with us was 2007.
Wow.
And then, Scott, you jumped aboard in 2008. So this really has been happening.
I thought it was like 1940 because I remember His Girl Friday showed up, Shop Around the
Corner.
We
have talked about that a lot.
It has come up quite a bit indeed. It's great to have you guys here. Before we jump right into our list, we are counting down our 10 through 6 picks from 2013 here on the show. Let's kick things off with one of our special guest voicemails. This is a really talented writer and director and a friend of the show, Ryan Johnson.
Hey, Josh and Adam. This is Ryan Johnson calling in with my top movie for 2013. And I know everyone's going to say this, but this was such an incredible year for movies. I can't do it. I can't do one. I got a top three. I got Her, Inside Llewyn Davis, and Upstream Color. But I could do a top 10. This has been just a great, great, great year. Wolf of Wall Street, The World's End, The Wind Rises, Stories We Tell. It's been ridiculous. Just so much good stuff at the theaters. Anyway, I hope you guys are well and have a great new year.
Our thanks to Ryan, even though he did cheat, even though at this point that's kind of a Film Spotting tradition. I've been trying to break myself of that habit with three picks. He said the year was just so good he could not pick between Inside Llewyn Davis, Her, and Upstream Color. I guess that is as good a place to start as any, Michael and Scott. When you look back on 2013, we always like to take a few minutes and sort of assess the year in general. Was this a good year? Everyone seems to think this was another pretty good year for cinema.
You know, it was. I guess the kind of most clinical measurement I can make of that is that the way I throw these lists together is not in any kind of order typically right away. In fact, I kind of resent having to rank them in order of preference. But
you sort of feel
your way to a group of 20, and at least in past years I have. And this year it really was more like a group of 30.
Wow.
It was like there were 30 films I've essentially felt warmly enough toward or strongly enough about that, you know, and then you sort of break the top 10 out of that. And really, honestly, with the flip of a coin, I could have swapped out half of them for the stuff that ended up being 11 through 30.
Now,
so,
in defense of ranking them, though, I mean, when you are forced to do that, even though you don't like to, don't you think it helps you to see some things in the movies rise up a little bit more that you didn't think about before? I mean, there's got to be something about those 10 that really jump out at you, or could it be close among those
30? I hate to say it. I just don't work that way. I think that tends to give – you're looking for artificial importance maybe, or you start giving points – for things you wouldn't ordinarily give points for. Like, you know,
looking for artificial importance, actually, the alternate title for this show. So that works well.
Yeah,
well,
that's next year's title.
I'm completely the other way, Michael. I'm totally comfortable comparing apples and oranges. I'm very pro apple these days. Honeycrisp apples specifically.
Aren't they
that's good?
They
delicious.
Are. They're yummy.
Totally. I would rank that well above an orange. So I have no problem ranking things. As far as the year, I mean, I thought it was a wonderful year for movies, but I also think that almost every year is a wonderful year for movies. That if you're really engaged and you're seeing as many films as you can, and from here and abroad, you know, it has a tendency to turn every year great.
Yeah.
And that was certainly the case this year. One thing I will say, though, about this year is that the films that were sort of trotted out as films that were supposed to be great, the prestige films of fall, delivered
right,
in a big
true.
Way.
Yep,
and, you know, and that's sometimes where things get a little bit dicey, because that's where you get your white elephants kind of come pounding through. But this year, everything that came out in the fall, with a couple of exceptions, really delivered.
Mm-hmm. I'm in agreement with both of you guys, actually, Michael, because it's a case for me where I look at that 20, and I really do start with that 20, and maybe didn't quite get to 30 where I felt really strongly, but nevertheless, those 11 through 20 picks were all movies that easily could have been in my 6 through 10 or maybe even a little bit higher. So
right.
You've got 20 movies you feel that strongly about. I think that has to say something about the year. At the same time, Scott, I'm with you. I say the same thing every year. I've never sat here at one of these year-end roundtables and said it's been a bad year. So either I really lack critical acumen, entirely possible, or the fact is, when you see enough movies, enough is going to rise to the top that makes it pretty decent.
Well, and it's a little bit of a separate issue that if the commercial film industry has a heartening or disheartening for a year, that's kind of a different story, you know, because we're not going to see the results of the churn and the, you know, in many ways, the collapse of a lot of the sort of traditional delivery models for film, all that. We're not going to really see all that for another year or two. I guess one thing, if you look at the list, it was a particularly good year for the U.S. stuff, and I had a little less foreign on my list this year than
I'm with you there as well.
And also an amazing year for documentaries as well.
Mm-hmm. Really strong.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump right in then, Michael. You're going to kick us off. Your number 10 film of 2013.
My number 10 is The Gatekeepers, the documentary by Dror Moreh, which is about the former heads of the Israeli Shin Bet intelligence agency, reflecting on Middle East peace and war. And I love this film because it's a rebuke to the whole notion that you can't make a really good cinematic talking heads doc. This is largely a talking heads doc, but there's a lot of really artful and subtle reenactments of some of the depictions of the historical crises we're dealing with here. And to me, this is just one of the most sobering and inarguably humane looks at a conflict that just seems like it will not end. And Not since No End in Sight, the Charles Ferguson doc about the prosecution of the Iraq War, have I seen a movie like this that worked this well for me.
Gatekeeper is a movie, I have to confess, I started one night on demand, really looking forward to it, got about 30 minutes in, started at like 11:30 at night.
Right.
Thought it was great, but did fall asleep, and then the on-demand ran out, and I never finished it.
I think it's better seen on request than on demand, Adam. I think it's more
there
of an attitude problem.
Okay,
you have.
that
though,
was my problem.
I think it's a terrific movie, too, and what was striking to me about it is that here are a bunch of guys who collectively pretty much come to the same conclusion, and that conclusion is, I think, opposed to what you think they would say in terms of, like, given what their job is, given that they're, you know, military men.
Retaliations don't work. They just,
right.
They, okay.
Right. I mean, that's a surprising thing to hear from those people.
It was.
Scott, your number 10.
Oh, my number 10 is, I think, will probably show up a little bit higher on other people's lists. It's 12 Years a Slave, the Steve McQueen movie about slavery. And slavery is one of those topics that I think people tend to approach, you know, carefully, I would say. And I'm not saying that this film is brazen exactly, but it is bold. You know, and it is very much a Steve McQueen film, like Hunger or Shame, that is about kind of brutality in the prisons of the body, prisons of the mind. And I was struck by how much of his personality as a filmmaker came through, and then just how uncompromising the film was. You know, you really get a very strong sense of the evils of slavery. You know, even more, what struck me too was, I just recently rewatched Django Unchained, which is a film I really love too. But that film, you know, had slavery in the context of exploitation, which you'd think would allow it to be more violent and more brutal. And I think this actually is tougher to watch, and maybe the bolder vision overall, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think bold is the right word. I do have it higher up on my list. I'll talk about the boldness a little bit as we go on here. My number 10, though, is a smaller American film, The Spectacular Now. Mm. And it's just this really precise character portrait that felt small when I first saw it, even though I really enjoyed it, that did end up sticking with me enough that it ended up on this list. Miles Teller plays a character named Sutter Keeley, and he's kind of the life of every high school party. But as the movie proceeds, he begins to realize the one thing that Wooderson, you know, the Matthew McConaughey character in Dazed and Confused, doesn't, is that this isn't much of a life once graduation goes by. You know, he's gonna have to come up with something else. And the dawning of that in this character is really well handled by the film and by Teller as well. So I also really like this movie. I'm sure others have done this, but not a lot of teen dramas, certainly teen comedies, do this, is really wrestle with teen alcoholism as something devastating and tragic. So appreciated that about it too.
Or they'll often do it, but in a really melodramatic way. And this is more just an everyday thing. It's part of his life. I think that is one of the things that's refreshing about that film. I'm just really glad that you finally discovered Miles Teller. He's a guy I really like as an actor.
Well, and the reason to see that film, I don't like it as much as you do, Josh, but I mean, Shailene
Woodley,
fantastic.
She is good at it. And one of the knocks on the film has been that she is underserved by it. But I'll go back to that description of it as this precise character portrait of the Teller character. I like that it focused on him. It's his story. It's not the teen romance that the marketing gave us, which I think is why there's a little bit of that backlash. And because she is so good, you do want to see more of her. I'll give you that.
Well, I was having such a hard time pinning down my top 10, Josh, as you know, we were talking about a week or so ago, that when I had to submit our picks for the Village Voice poll and then the IndieWire poll, I only submitted 7 movies, a top 7 to the Village Voice, and then a top 8 to IndieWire because I had focused in on my number 8. But I really just finally picked my number 10 and 9 choices today because I absolutely had to in preparation for this show. And one of the things that I was weighing as I was thinking about all those artificially important things, Michael, is I don't tend to give a lot of love to comedies in top 10 lists.
Well, you're not funny. You're not a funny guy.
Exactly. Yeah. I have no sense of humor whatsoever. That's a fact. So I was thinking I probably have never given more than one slot to a comedy over the years, and probably some years have had 10 picks that wouldn't really constitute or qualify as comedy. So with that in mind, I did want to go with a comedy for my number 10 slot, and it wasn't a hard choice at all. It is The World's End, the movie director Edgar Wright, of course, with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, part of their Cornetto trilogy, along with Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. And I put it there at number 10 for being the movie that did make me laugh the most in 2013. But even more than that, you've got this movie about high school friends who have been out of touch with each other. 20 years later, you've got Gary King, the Simon Pegg character. Basically, his life's at a complete dead end. And he says, well, everything would be better for me if I could just go back and recreate this one night that should have been my night of glory. And they go back to their hometown and embark on this pub crawl. It is also a movie about old friendships. It's about our capacity for rationalization, our craving for nostalgia, a lot of other things, including the nature of addiction. I think it actually really hits on that well, to follow up your pick, Josh, of The Spectacular Now. When we reviewed it, I set you up, Josh, actually talking about those how in the hell did they do that moments that you get in Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, and Nick Frost movies, where the movies are just so absurd, but then you also find yourself discovering these really honest, genuinely emotional, powerful human moments amidst all that craziness, that aliens in the town taking over the town absurdity. And The World's End has all sorts of moments like that. I think it's all anchored by Nick Frost, very good performance, but Simon Pegg as well. I think you maybe favored Frost, Josh, when we talked about it. But for me, he is the king. He is that character who has to be the guy that you understand is able to sell these friends who don't really want to see him and don't really want to embark on this night. He's able to do it through sheer persuasion and the power of his personality, and he does sell us.
5 guys, 12 pubs, 50 pints.
60 pints.
Oh, steady on you, Alky.
I haven't had a drink for 16 years, Gary.
You must be thirsty, then. But we can go back, see the guys, chew the fat, and it'll be just like it always was, except this time we are going to finish this thing once and for all.
You have a very selective memory, Gary.
Thanks.
You remember the Friday nights. I remember the Monday mornings.
Yeah, that's why we're going back on a Friday.
I think it's the most charismatic, the most roguishly charming we've ever seen, Simon Pegg, but I think he balances that by also being the darkest we've ever seen him. So there are the two extremes in that performance, and I'm a big fan of The World's End, my number 10.
Yeah, well, The World's End is an extremely funny movie and was definitely kind of hovering around my list. But I think it's one of those comedies that if it weren't so funny and so entertaining, it would be just brutally depressing to consider the point at which this character that Simon Pegg plays sort of finds himself. And also to consider this idea, this whole starbucking idea that the movie advances, this place that they've returned to that was so full of character in life has become homogenized,
right?
And everything is the same. And what is this world that we've created for ourselves? So both in terms of the Peg's character and the world of the film, you know, you just, what does this all this mean? It's a midlife crisis movie.
Yeah,
and a great one, I think.
Well, that brings us to our number 9 picks, Michael. What do you have?
That's another doc. To Scott's point of it being a very good, you know, I never actually counted up, Scott, how many documentaries made my top 10, and I got 3 out of 10. And if you look at my top 30, it's like a bunch of them. So anyway, mm-hmm. My number 9 is Let the Fire Burn, Jason Osder's documentary account of the 1985 standoff between the MOVE organization, the revolutionary group in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia law enforcement, and that did not end well. This is a remarkable use of. I don't think there's a single on-screen crawl. I don't think there's any voiceover narration. It is simply found, you know, it's interview tapes, depositions, things like that. It is brilliantly put together, and you just get this wonderful, dreadful sense of accumulating dread, really, as you get closer and closer to what actually happened. When they did in fact let the fire burn, but that's another great documentary. I love it.
Is that one that is available now? If you need to see it on Netflix or streaming, are you aware?
I believe
because
it is.
I haven't seen it.
I don't know. I don't think it is initially.
Really?
Yeah, Zeitgeist Films put it out, but they didn't. They put it out fairly late in the year. I think probably in the fall. So I don't think it will be finding its way out. I guess it's something that you'll have to look into. But
yeah.
But I'm a huge fan of it as well. I love that movie. And it's got, like, I think Senna's another example of just taking of a movie that's just constructed entirely out of existing footage.
Mm-hmm.
There are some titles.
That's right.
The film has a really wonderful kind of organizing principle where there's a committee, a city committee that's sort of piecing through the story, and it kind of gives
about
the film
6 months after the event.
Exactly. Yeah, and it kind of gives you a great sense of civic responsibility, you know, and I think the film is a very fair film. It's a great journalistic achievement and a really good pick.
It's one I can't wait to see, and we'll link to more information about that movie if we can find it, and I'm sure we can in our show notes at filmspotting.net. Scott, what's your number 9?
Okay, my number 9 is another documentary, The Act of Killing, by Joshua Oppenheimer. And this is just representative of a year in which documentaries were really pushing the form and getting beyond the sort of tried and true talking heads and archival footage formula and doing things that were really striking. And for a lot of Act of Killing, I couldn't believe that this film existed, that this was happening. It follows these guys who were part of this genocide that cost the lives of thousands of people. One of them, is personally responsible for 1,000, perhaps that many anyway. And they want to, they're big cinema fans, so there are a lot of reenactments and stagings, and it's just an immensely disturbing experience, but revealing too. That's what the camera does. The camera kind of shows you, it reveals truths that I don't think you really could, even like a journalistic account of this story.
Have you guys seen this film yet?
Yes,
yeah,
indeed.
Scott's beating me to the punch with his second pick here. That'll be talked about later on my list as well. It's remarkable. It's really something.
Yeah.
It stands out in a crowded field of documentaries, I think, for some of the reasons you talked about, the form it takes and that sort of thing. So, yeah, we'll talk more about that. But right now I want to talk about one of our Golden Brick nominees here at Film Spotting, Underseen Films, that Adam and I talked about earlier and just think deserves a little more attention. And it's Beyond the Hills, actually, which is Kristen Munju's film. It's really a haunting horror movie, even though you don't realize that it belongs in that genre until after it's over, possibly well after it's over. It has Cosmina Stratton and Christina Flatour as both giving really great performances. They're friends who grew up in the same orphanage but have gone their separate ways. Stratton is now a nun, and Flatour is kind of living this, you get the impression, somewhat reckless life, and she's trying to bring her friend away from the religious life she's taken on. And it does become, eventually it makes its way to an exorcism. And you don't even realize that as you're watching it. And really, it's one of the most unsettling exorcism movies I've seen. And we did revisit The Exorcist this year. So I would compare it to that as well. It's just this disturbing story of two women who find themselves in this shadowy land between superstition and faith.
Yeah, it's a pip. I mean, that's a film where the first time I saw it at the Cannes Film Festival, it was a little less immediately, I guess, powerful or concise, certainly, as Munju's previous film of 4 months, 3 weeks.
Doesn't have that wow.
2 days, no, but then, you know, 8 months later, you know, happy to see it a second time for the Chicago production and a full review, and that film had more going on in it than 90% of what I saw, you know, that whole 6 months. So yeah, no, that's on my it just missed my top.
It's my 14. I love that movie.
It is in my 11 through 20 as well. I didn't rank it though, like you, Scott. My number 9 is not a foreign film. It is not a documentary. It is an American movie from director Jeff Nichols. It's Mud. The movie starring Matthew McConaughey. It's another movie following Shotgun Stories and Take Shelter, Nichols' previous two films, about marriage, about intimacy, about communication. It's also a coming-of-age tale, this time where you have two characters, junior high-age kids, Ellis and his friend Neckbone, and Ellis is played by Ty Sheridan. Great performance, but both kids are played wonderfully. It's set along the Mississippi River in Arkansas, and they come upon one day an island with this mysterious character played by Matthew McConaughey. He is the title character, Mud, and it becomes not just that coming-of-age story, but also its own kind of fairy tale, which I think comes through in one of these early encounters between Mud and the boys.
Why do you have that pistol?
Protection. You don't need to be afraid of me. I got two ways to protect myself out here, this shirt and this pistol. There are fierce powers at work in the world, boys. Good, evil, poor luck, best luck. As men, we gotta take advantage where we can. Y'all coming?
I love that line from Mud about fierce powers at work. And of course, when you get to the end of that, he talks about being men. We have to take advantage of what we can. That quote, I think, really does highlight what the movie is also about, what all of Jeff Nichols' movies are about, which is manhood and masculinity. And for me, Mud was just a film that felt like a great novel in terms of the texture of the story, the richness of the characters. And I think what really has now come through three movies from Nichols is that he really makes films about characters having to face, usually through some external force, the breakdown of their worldviews. They previously saw things as pretty black and white, and then they have that worldview subverted in some way. And the way I described it during our review of Mud, Josh, was there are characters who have to confront the in-between. And I think that's what Nichols does really well. I also think it's one of the best ensembles of 2013. If you look at that whole cast, not just the boys and McConaughey, Reese Witherspoon, Ray McKinnon, Sam Shepard, Michael Shannon, of course, appears, Sarah Paulson, Joe Don Baker, Paul Sparks also in there, people may recognize from Boardwalk Empire. So for me, Mud was just a movie that gets every detail so right and everything feels so authentic that when Nichols maybe goes astray a little bit near the end with some contrived scenes and a couple characters that feel a little bit too convenient to the plot, it really does stand out, but not enough to derail the film for me.
I really love that film up until the moment they introduced a lot of people with guns just so they could kill them off. You know, and to me, that's a strange misstep for an otherwise great, really, really good movie.
Would you say, Adam, it's your favorite McConaughey performance this year? Because he's given three that have all gotten a lot of talk.
I don't know.
Dallas Buyers Club and Wolf of Wall Street, which is really almost a cameo, but
yeah,
it is mine. I think he's fantastic in Mud. I think he uses his personality just right.
I could see that argument. I do appreciate all three performances, though. I don't know how I would weigh them.
That 5 minutes in Wolf of Wall Street is
amazing.
Really something.
It really is something. You're listening to Film Spot with Adam and Josh, and with our special guests, as we usually are this time of year, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and Scott Tobias from The Dissolve. We have shared our number 10 and number 9 picks for the best films of 2013. That brings us to number 8, Michael.
Not a documentary, but, you know, halfway there. Inside Llewyn Davis, directed by the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan, which asked the question, really, was this guy, Llewyn Davis, played by Oscar Isaac, born too soon, too late, or was he just unlucky? And it's a week in this man's life in the winter of 1961 as he's basically crashing from couch to couch, uptown, downtown, and chasing after a lost cat. And you can talk about a lot of the film and make it sound completely, you know, reductive and absurd in its dark comedy. You can also talk about the fact that it's a really, truly death-haunted work that's dealing with the suicide of one character we never meet. It's dealing with the near, you know, a dying father we meet toward the end. And there's a lot of ghosts rattling around in this picture. And that's why I think this particularly melancholy comedy from the Coens, though it's not quite up to my favorites of theirs. It's gotten the most critical heat of any movie this year. And like a lot of films, I saw it a second. I liked it the first time. I really liked it the second time.
Please, Mr. Kennedy, take one, and we're rolling.
Second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy. I don't want to go.
Don't shoot me in the outer space.
Oh, please, Mr. Kennedy. I don't want to go.
Don't shoot me in the outer space.
I sweat when they stuff me in the pressure suits. Rubble, helmet, flash, board, and boots. Nowhere up there
outer?
In gravity zero.
Space.
I need to breathe.
Outer?
Don't need to be a hero.
Space.
Reading me loud and clear, oh, please, Mr. Kennedy.
That soundtrack, I'll just say for now, my kids are so tired of me singing Please Don't Shoot Me into Outer Space and singing Fairly Well. I just walk around all day long
outer
singing songs.
Space.
Exactly.
There was a thing with that soundtrack where that the longer the song Fairly Well kept playing through my brain, the film just kept creeping higher and higher
that's
on
it.
My top 10 list.
That's all planned. That's
me.
All planned.
Yeah.
Scott, your number eight.
My number eight is Nebraska by Alexander Payne. I always like to joke about Alexander Payne's Midwestern films that I enjoy them because I get to visit my relatives. And this had that kind of feeling to it. He presents this region like nobody else. And the thing I really love about Nebraska is that it's a comedy drama that works both angles at once, that as we're laughing, we're also getting this tour through the wreckage of this man's life, you know, this distant father who is revealing things that his son's learning about his father. And it's a very sad tale that's being told, but it's also hilarious. and I love that push and pull.
Yeah, we see it with Bruce Dern, with that main character as the father. So good in that performance.
I'm going to officially just start saying ditto after Scott makes his picks because we're in lockstep here so far. Although Nebraska isn't my number eight. My number eight is This Is the End. And yes, Adam, I did like The World's End too, quite a bit. But for me, I just prefer this ramshackle sort of improvisational idiocy that's going on in this stateside apocalypse comedy. It's got Seth Rogen, James Franco, Jonah Hill, a whole host of other celebrities all playing themselves. They end up holed up in Franco's mansion as the world burns.
It's gone, guys.
So I think we should probably go back to your place, eh?
What are you talking about, man? No way. I'm not leaving here.
I don't want to die at James Franco's house.
We need to stay here until they start rescuing people, okay?
A huge earthquake happens. Who do they rescue first? Actors.
Famous people.
They'll get Clooney, Sandra Bullock, me. If there's room, you guys will come. The point is that we're all going to get out of this first.
This just has, I mean, it goes without saying, it's very funny. Just everyone here can get a laugh, and I love watching them compete against each other trying to do that. But also, I saw it as this younger, it's so eviscerating of Hollywood, the Hollywood scene and stature and that sort of thing. It's almost a younger, Fowler version of Robert Altman's The Player in a lot of ways. And it also has this, you know, amusing eschatology thrown in there at the end about the end of the world. So loved that movie quite a bit.
I saw you guys do a little cheer over
yes.
here. Am I really the only one in the room who thinks The World's End is the by far superior work and that This Is the End has some amazing bits and a great conceit eventually wears out its welcome?
What's weird, I mean, what,
am I the
it
only
keeps
one?
Building. Wears out its welcome is the opposite of what
it
does.
You're talking about, it is, I like these films, I like these comedies both equally and they both.
And it's not fair to set them up against each other, speaking of apples and oranges.
And one really is like semi-improvised, ramshackle, it just barely hangs together with scotch tape. This is the end. And you know, The World's End is a much tighter, insane mixture of tones and styles, but very, you know, much more kind of fastidious in the way.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow they both come off like they just got the people that wrote it and acted it just sort of rolled out of bed and did it. And that is, it's got a wonderful feeling, both of them. I really like both.
And the fact that it can be that funny, though, while having that sort of tone and that shagginess, I mean, that's real talent to make that work. They didn't just get lucky, I guess,
well, I think
is what I'm saying.
But with all those jizz jokes, it's amazing it's that funny.
Can you say that on NPR? He just did.
Let me say about This Is the End that it was really the most excited I was seeing a Hollywood movie this summer. That you know, you get really inundated with films that play it so safe and within a certain template. You know, they're very expensive and no one is taking any chances. And this film kind of showed you how you could do a film on a pretty large scale, you know, an apocalypse film, and do it in a very personal, extremely raunchy and kind of edgy way. You know, I thought this was like this is a great way forward. Let's see more of this from Hollywood.
No, and there is something really. I think what makes it fresh is what you're getting at a little bit, Josh, about it. It really is kind of merciless about the ego of comedians.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
And everybody just comes off awfully, you know, and no one better or worse than Franco. And mm-hmm. James Franco is really kind of his own country at this point. I mean, you know.
Well, speaking of James Franco, what a great transition into my number 8 film of the year. This is The American Dream. This is my dream, y'all. I got Scarface on repeat.
Here we go.
You knew it was coming out. Scarface on repeat. Constant, y'all. James Franco and Spring Breakers is my number 8 film of the year from Harmony Korine, the director. It had to make my list mainly for James Franco's alien character. I'm on record as saying I think Franco at this point should only play these kinds of roles. He needs to play characters like this. I think he's so much more interesting as an actor when he truly disappears into a character, which he does a lot, versus when he's kind of playing variations on himself. Also, I had to pick it for the Britney Spears sing-along scene, which I love, but the main reason it's on my list and the reason it's at number 8 is because I think there is a time capsule element to forming these lists. For me, anyway, I do consider that. I think about 10 years from now, looking back on the year in film, and hopefully my top 10 list has some resemblance to what I think of overall as the year in film. And Sam Adams, Scott, your friend, who you introduced me to and who writes for IndieWire, he certainly had that in mind as well. He recently wrote an article about why Spring Breakers, even though I think the headline called it ludicrous and imbecilic, is the movie of 2013. And this is what Sam said. Spring Breakers isn't one of my top 10 or even 15 or 20, but I think that Spring Breakers is unquestionably the movie of the year in the sense that Pope Francis is Time's Person of the Year. Not the best movie of 2013, but the most 2013 of them. If you want to show future generations where the United States of America was at in 2013, plug Spring Breakers right into their skulls. And Michael, obviously your former partner, A.O. Scott from the New York Times, had that in mind as well. He had Spring Breakers and like 17 other movies as his cheat for his number 10 film of the year. He basically combined a bunch of films about the American dream and that sense of entitlement for his list. But the difference between me and Sam, based on what he said, is I don't think Spring Breakers is just the most 2013 of 2013 movies. I actually think it's a really, really good film, one of the best as well. I think it goes well beyond just voyeuristic gazing and the debauchery going on screen. When you watch these characters trying to place their lives in some kind of grander cultural or even spiritual, as they may see it, context, and assign meaning to their lives, which is really what every character in every film was probably trying to do. They're trying to find tangible ways to define who they are and define their success. And I actually think the schizophrenic aspect to the film in terms of its style is really a strength. I think that Korine is challenging in all the right ways. And I think something I noted during our review, Josh, that it's up to the viewer ultimately to decide whether or not all those party scenes look like the best time ever or your version of hell. But for me, it really is about this clash of this fantasy version of the lives of these characters and the reality and what happens when reality comes face to face and smacks fantasy around a little bit.
It's such a crafty movie. I mean, I think I need to see that one again. I liked it, and that one has stuck with me a long time. And what I really think kind of cements it is what you're talking about, where you have the robbery scene of this larky group of girls on spring break. You think it's just sort of like fun and games, and they sort of somehow get away with kind of a nonviolent comic relief robbery of a diner at the front, and then an hour later into the picture, you see what actually went on, and that is the mark of a really astute director, where you can kind of get really the laugh kind of catches in your throat, and suddenly this movie really makes its point clear. It's a damn subversive movie. Kind of like This Is the End is too, and that maybe it was a good year for these sort of stealthy subversive genre picture.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about this time capsule thing, though. Did anyone else, obviously, Adam, and you didn't feel this way, but did it strike you as dated at all? I mean, from the fact that they're using Britney Spears, I mean, she's not existent in 2013. None of them use cell phones. Social media is not an aspect of these college kids' lives. It didn't reflect contemporary society to me at all. And I think something like The Real World Cancun was like how many, 10 years ago now, was depicting the same thing. So I just don't get this idea of Korine's movie really reflecting anything that we haven't known for quite some time.
Maybe anymore. It doesn't reflect it any more than one of my worst films of the year, Michael Bay's Pain and Gain. We'll get there.
That's a much better film about the American dream.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Josh.
No,
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
No,
We're coming up to that. I'm sure we're coming up to that. No, that's an interesting point, but I think that's also what makes it sort of timeless. The thing that those girls are after, the things I'm talking about and trying to assign meaning to their lives and grabbing onto these cultural signifiers, those are things that happen to every generation. You make them up as you go, and a lot of generations do crave nostalgia the same way The World's End does. So we get those hearkening back to things like Scarface and to Britney Spears. I think that that all makes sense. It's just all part of this cultural stew that Harmony Korine is playing with in Spring Breakers. I absolutely think, especially when you do look at all those films that A.O. Scott and others have talked about, it felt 2013 in every sense of it to me, about this sense of entitlement, really.
It didn't feel like enervating to you after a while. I felt like I was...
Wait, are we talking about The Wolf of Wall Street now?
Oh, well, yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, in terms of just, you know, you get... at 10 minutes at a time, it's just, it's spectacular. And then it's like, why am I, I'm feeling like I'm being hit with the same thing here again and again. But I have a bit of a Korine allergy. So,
well, I hear there's a shot for that.
This came as close as ever to me getting over that allergy. I will say that.
Well, Korine got his due. Roland Emmerich is probably getting nervous that White House Down hasn't been mentioned yet, but there are still 7 slots to go. We're each going to share 2 more picks next. Stay with us.
Time of year to say thanks, Josh, and that's exactly what we're going to do here with our donations and our thank yous to everyone who went to filmspotting.net, went to PayPal, and donated some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. And before we get to those donations and a few comments, we do want to say thanks, as we have for the past few years, to Sam Smith, one of our friends and a movie lover, a movie expert, is a musician and a great graphic designer as well, and he helps us every year during this Top 10 show pick some of the best movie scores and soundtracks to feature. And you just heard Lucero's Snakebite from the Jeff Nichols movie Mud, and Lucero's frontman Ben Nichols is Jeff's brother. Coming out of the break, you're going to hear Thomas Newman's Side Effects score, the song Very Sick Girl. So our thanks again to Sam for helping us pick those. And it just turns out this year, Josh, that usually he picks scores that I didn't even think of or were completely off my radar. This year he picked 5 or 6 for us to choose from, and they were all among my favorite scores of the year. So maybe I'm getting better at this. Maybe he's helped shape my taste.
You've been trained.
In music compositions. Again, we thank Sam. And we also thank one of our new donors. She is a $10 a month donor.
Shelley from Austin, Texas.
We also have 2 new gold level donors to the show.
That would be Clifton from Denver, Colorado, and Larry, also from Austin. Larry says, thanks for all the excellent work. I truly appreciate your show week after week.
We have 3 new $5 a month donors.
Karen from Cincinnati, Ohio, Chris from Indianapolis, and Jane from Waterloo, New South Wales, Australia.
A new buck a show donor. That's $1 for every week of the year, even the weeks where we're not doing a new show. How about that, Josh?
Thanks, Kim from Olive Branch, Mississippi.
We also have a Silver Club donor, Glenn, in Sacramento, California, and some other donors we want to thank this week, including some nice comments here we got from Joe in Cincy.
I'm a 29-year-old who's been a film buff ever since I was a kid. I'm forever in debt to my sweet, naive mother who let me watch Psycho and The Shining when I was way too young. These movies showed me what movies could be and set me on a path to discover greater and greater films for the next 20-odd years. Movies are a passion that my identical twin Josh and I share. So when he discovered your podcast earlier this year, he immediately told me that I had to listen to it, and we've been hooked ever since. Your show has been a great jumping-off point for us to find new films and directors, and has also helped spur our debate-loving minds to even greater and longer debates, much to the annoyance of our wives, with whom we eat lunch every day.
After listening to all the newest episodes among hundreds from the archives, we've discovered that my brother Josh typically agrees with Adam, and I typically agree with Josh, Larson not Heiser, with a few major exceptions, of course.
Show goes on. My favorite film spotting discovery is Jeff Nichols. He's making movies, as I like to say, that people just don't make anymore. Particularly Mud was a huge favorite of mine this year. Josh, that's his brother, his favorite film spotting discovery is much older and film snobbier, Truffaut. And one last thing, I have to give some love to my favorite movie, Spirit of the Beehive. This is a film I fell in love with about 5 years ago, and I've yet to find anyone who has seen it, much less loves it, the way I do. It would make me so happy if people would check this film out from hearing about it on the show. Thanks for doing so much for the spreading of great films and film criticism. I hope to be able to donate more in the future. Spirit of the Beehive, a movie... Josh, I believe not only have I seen, but I'm pretty sure I had to write a paper about it in college.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what year is it?
Of course you have to hit me with that.
Well, I know nothing about it. I mean, you got to give me a little something.
It was about 15 years ago I wrote that paper. So
and it was a new movie at that
blank.
Time?
No,
oh,
no.
I see.
No,
okay.
I don't believe it was a new movie at the time. So there you go. I'll have to go back into my archives, get out the floppy disk that I was using to save my files and see what I knew then about Spirit of the Beehive. Other donors we want to thank this week include
Emily in Washington, D.C., and Christina and Peter Biro. They say thank you for another great year. They're loyal film spotting listeners in Stockholm, Sweden.
We also got a donation from Ryan in Portland, Oregon, who says, thanks for another great year of shows. I appreciate all your hard work and passion. It is clearly reflected every week in the quality of each and every show. And that brings us to our final donor and our final comment for the week. Larry Carino in Pembroke Pines, Florida.
Well, guys, it sure took me long enough, but enough was enough, and it was time to put my money where my ears are. I've been listening to the show for over a year now, and though Adam usually makes me want to steer my car into an abutment, how dare you attack Pitt's performance in California, sir? How dare you? Michael Phillips makes me nuts. Don't get me started on his insights in The Shining. And Josh is so off base with The Exorcist, my soul died a little during your sacred cow discussion. You're great. Oh, despite all that, we're great. Wow. Larry goes on, I don't get to see movies the way I used to. I'm a relatively new dad, so each DVD rental or movie night is precious. You've turned me on to some fabulous finds, Snow Angels, and not so fabulous as well, House. Regardless, love the banter, the insights, and your cool insights, even if I don't always agree. Happy holidays and keep up the good work.
Well, I do feel like we should point out, and this goes back to the start of this segment, it was Sam Smith who was the conduit for any recommendation for the film House. It's a movie neither of us have seen, but Sam actually did the artwork for the Criterion Collection edition. I think it was the poster he did for the run of House, that cult classic at the Belcour in Nashville, that got Criterion's attention. So that was why it got mentioned on the show. I think a listener wrote in praising it as well, but it's a film we both need to see. So we didn't steer you wrong there, but I guess we did put it on your radar there, Larry. Thank you for those kind words. And I guess I should end with a little bit of an apology, Josh. I think it was Justin last week who I said sent us a nice letter in the mail, went to the P.O. box, and I forgot to bring that letter with me, and he was going to get featured 2 weeks in a row on the show. And as it turns out, nope, I'm just going to apologize 2 weeks in a row on the show.
So is he going to be possibly a third week on the show?
Yeah.
How's this going to work?
Eventually,
okay.
It'll just probably be after the first of the year,
okay.
Unfortunately. But that is the one peril of sending us a nice letter. There's no electronic receipt. There's nothing I can go
True.
Reference. I have to actually carry that thing around. I do apologize, Justin. As I said, that was our last donation segment of 2013, even though we have one more show coming and probably even another podcast coming. But we do want to take this opportunity to thank everyone who donated. Even if it was $1 this year, you really did keep us doing what we're doing.
Hi, my name's Steve Coogan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Hey, Adam, Josh, and Film Spotting Nation, it's Peter Labuza from the Cinephiliacs podcast calling in with my favorite movie of 2013, Alexander Sokurov's Faust, a wildly insane rabbit hole trip in the Russian director's adaptation of Goethe's classical epic. This film grabbed me from its first image and didn't let go for the next 2 hours. If anything, Sokurov continues to prove himself a true original, and that's why this is the best film for me. Keep up the great work, and I'll see you guys in 2014.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. We're here with our special guests from The Dissolve, Scott Tobias and Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. If they're here, you know it is top 10 of the year time. And coming back into the segment, you just heard Peter Labuza, a longtime Film Spotting listener, host of the Cinephiliacs podcast, with his number one film of the year. It is Sokurov's adaptation of Faust, a movie unseen at this point by Josh and myself, but of course our much more learned experts here in the room. You guys have both seen it. What do you think about Labuza's choice?
Brave. And I like the film, but to me it's nowhere near the best of what Sokurov's done in the last decade or decade and a half. And in fact, at times I thought I was watching a Terry Gilliam film. I mean, it's so much more manic in the style than his usual stuff. But yeah, Brave, you know, but what the hell? Good for him.
It has a tactile quality that I admire.
I like that. It's beautiful. I'm going to use that phrase again.
It is at times quite beautiful and also deliberately quite ugly. But I really feel like the actual text of the thing, like the conversation, is completely incoherent to me. Mm. Obviously, it's probably quite meaningful to Peter, but it was completely lost on me.
Okay. Well, with that, we will get back to our countdown of the best films of 2013 here in a moment. Right now, though, it's time for Massacre Theater.
We're going to perform a scene, and you'll get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene.
Mr. Abbott says, moment of realization. Moment of realization is worth a thousand prayers.
A little crazy, man.
Well, yeah, I don't think I'm any crazier than you are. I'm extreme, dark, and light. You know that. I'm light with mouth. Mouth. That's your shadow on the wall, you know? Can't get rid of your shadow, can you? No, you know, the only thing that kills a demon, love. That's why I know that Mallory's my salvation. She was teaching me how to love.
I forgive you, baby.
Yeah. It's just like being in the Garden of Eden.
Only love can kill the demon. Hold that thought.
That was Robert Downey Jr. as Wayne Gale and Woody Harrelson as Mickey Knox in Natural Born Killers from 1994. It was written by David Veloz, Richard Rutowski, and Oliver Stone, although it was based, of course, on a story by Quentin Tarantino, Stone directed.
And the tie-in was Woody Harrelson playing a scary guy, like he does in Out of the Furnace, the movie we reviewed last week on the show. And we also shared the results of our film spotting poll question. We can't call it a death match because there were more than two participants. A listener had a great idea. It's a film spotting battle royale where we ask listeners to pick which of these four Out of the Furnace stars, if only one of them could continue making movies, who would it be? Great poll question. Bale, Harrelson, Forest Whitaker, and Casey Affleck. It was a challenging one for us, and I'm curious to get your guys' responses. I'm just throwing that on you right now, Michael. Which of those four, if only one of them can continue making movies, who can't you live without?
Well, you played the dullest part in that movie, but Forest Whitaker, probably.
Really?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a stupid question, Adam.
I'll take it.
What are the four choices again?
The four choices: Affleck, Bale, Harrelson, Whitaker.
Just say Affleck and it'll
I'm
be fine.
I'm going to say Woody Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson.
I'm always surprised and delighted by Woody Harrelson.
My choice and the correct choice. We heard from Tim Berthume right here in Chicago. It's pretty rare for me to get these. He thought this scene was easy. Well, Tim, only about 20 people entered this, one of our lowest ever. So apparently something about either your Australian accent via
you're
Robert
blame it on
Jr.
that,
or my terrible take on Woody Harrelson,
which had a little bit of Franco in it, by the way, I might add.
Did it?
It's going to be in every one of your Massacre Theaters now. You love it so much.
Well, speaking of that, Bob Blenheim in Daytona Beach, Florida. There you go. Spring Breakers. He said, Adam, you've given us a really idiosyncratic Mickey Knox that won't actually burn itself into our memories, but helped us appreciate Woody Harrelson all the more. If you intended your interpretation of Harrelson to help us decide to vote for him in your poll, you've succeeded.
That's what you were going for.
That
wasn't
what I was going for, but you know what? That's fine. If you want to hear that scene or our review of Out of the Furnace and our top five surprises and disappointments of 2013, you can hear that at filmspotting.net or get the show via iTunes. So, Josh, there's lots of room in the film spotting hat to pick out a winner. Go ahead and reach in and do it.
That would be Aaron Perry from West Des Moines, Iowa.
Congratulations, Aaron. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your film spotting t-shirt.
Martin, look at me.
I am looking at you.
Now look at me the way I'm looking at you. Put it in your eyes. You're mine, asshole, without saying it.
How about this?
What are you telling me? That you're sleepy? That you want to go to bed?
we get now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. Always tough to find a four-person scene, but we have found it thanks to our producer, Sam Van Halgren, because we do have to employ the acting talents of Scott Tobias and Michael Phillips here. And our listeners love to read between the lines and come up with all these unintended tie-ins for our Massacre Theater scenes. Usually we're just going for the most obvious one. In this case, I think Sam's done a really good job of finding five or six different connections to the year in film. So we'll see if listeners come up with something even beyond that. I'm going to start it off. Josh, you're going to give me the action. Are you guys ready over there?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And action.
Have your clothes cleaned and send me the bill.
I'll send it to you at Glades.
Jeez, what, you crawl through a sewer?
Take your sunglasses off.
I see better with them on.
You don't take them off. I'm going to throw them off the overpass while they're still on your head. Wait in the car.
You're in civilization now, man. Ease up.
I'd like you to go wait in the car. How's that? Take her with you and put her in back.
In the trunk?
The back seat.
Come on, I have to do what I'm told.
Wait a minute. Let me have your raincoat. Somebody forgot to bring me clean clothes.
I brought them. They're back at Glades in the Cadillac. You wanted to take her car.
You can blame me if you want. I don't mind.
And scene.
You didn't strain yourself there, Scott, did you?
Okay. None of us.
Was my reading a little flat?
No, just with the one line, you know.
Oh, okay.
Overwork.
None of us sounded anything like the characters there. Josh, you were the closest.
Was I?
I'll give you that.
I was trying.
Oh,
so. I thought Michael did pretty good.
Well,
if somehow you know what
it's all about posture.
There was a feminine lilt in your voice.
It was about the posture.
Well, if you couldn't tell from the performances, I think there were enough textual hints in there to identify what film we just massacred. If you did get it, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. You have all the way until January 1st to get your entries in. We actually won't announce the winner until our live show, the Film Spotting Wrap Party, on January 11th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced at the wrap party. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Anywhere within 300 miles of Medina, there are Hashemite Bedouins. They can cross 60 miles of desert in a day.
Oh, thanks, Triton. This is going to be fun.
Lawrence. Only two kinds of creature get fun in the desert, Bedouins and gods, and you're neither. Take it from me. For ordinary men, it's a burning, fiery furnace.
No, Dryden. It's going to be fun.
It is recognized that you have a funny sense of fun.
Claude Rains as Mr. Dryden and the late Peter O'Toole as T.E. Lawrence in Lawrence of Arabia, the David Lean epic masterpiece from 1962. Peter O'Toole, 81 years old when he passed away here last week, an 8-time Oscar nominee. In addition to Peter O'Toole, we lost Joan Fontaine. She was 96 years old. You may remember her from Rebecca and Suspicion. And if you did follow along with our Max Ophuls marathon last year, you would know her from a great performance in Letter from an Unknown Woman. So the passing of two great performers last week in O'Toole and Fontaine.
Tough. It's horrible to lose. It's like Shakespeare said, you know, these things don't come in single spies, they come in battalions. And when you lose, you know, great people like this in sort of this breathless week, ugh, you know, it kind of puts a little ashen taste in your mouth. But on the other hand, the work was so great. And O'Toole just was such an exuberant, I mean, God knows he elevated his share of crap, but when he had good material, especially when he was younger, it was just a marvelous discovery. And Fontaine, a very interesting quality, I think. Hmm. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Ophuls film Letters from an Unknown Woman, because that's really her best performance and probably the best film she ever was associated with.
Do you have a favorite Peter O'Toole performance, or would T.E. Lawrence
you know,
be
it? I really think The Stuntman is the one that people should see if they haven't seen, because that's a film that, you know, people enjoy, but it doesn't really enjoy high regard, and it's one of the best parts he had post-Lean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it kind of takes advantage of his sort of magisterial quality.
Yeah,
and also the fact that, you know, Noel Murray wrote a piece on our site about O'Toole that was talking about how, you know, he's so beautiful and so glamorous and so witty, but he was also kind of unknowable, and he left a little mystery behind. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of what makes him so compelling.
Well, as we were talking about Fontaine and our Ophuls marathon, a little tease, we are going to be revisiting our Max Ophuls marathon and that film, Letter from an Unknown Woman, on the January 10th show. So look forward to that if you did miss it from earlier in the year. And we do hope you don't miss our upcoming Film Spotting Wrap Party. As we hinted there, we talked about during Massacre Theater, we're going to announce the winner of our latest Massacre Theater round, and we are going to reflect on the year in cinema and get to some of our favorite scenes of the year, some of our favorite performances of the year, and many more. Michael Phillips will be our guest again.
Thank you.
And
thank
hopefully
you
we can convince
me.
Scott Tobias to drop by. Maybe we'll get him up on stage for a quick performance. And we are looking forward to it. It was a blast last year, hoping to make it an annual event. It's at the main stage again. Great venue here in Chicago. It is going to be on a Saturday afternoon. Hopefully some out-of-towners can come partake in the festivities. It is Saturday, January 11th. Tickets are available now at mainstage.com, M-A-Y-N-E, or you can find a direct link there at filmspotting.net.
We are not sold out yet, but we did last year, so
we
don't wait on it too long.
And we're getting close, but there are still tickets available. So we hope to see you there. Let's go ahead now and get back to our top 10 movies of 2013 countdown. We're going to jump into our number 7 picks with the help of critic Callum Marsh. You may be familiar with his writing for Sight and Sound, The Atlantic, The Village Voice, Esquire, basically everywhere Callum contributes articles to, and he is going to be yet another cheater with his number 1 film of the year.
For about 11 months of the year, my favorite film of 2013 was Lucienne Casting-Taylor and Verena Paravel's experimental documentary Leviathan, and I'd assumed it would stay that way for the rest of the year. But I recently saw both Spike Jonze's Her and Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street, and now, to be honest, I think I may have a 3-way tie. In any case, it's clearly been an excellent year for cinema, and any of those 3 choices would be an excellent number 1.
Well, speaking of it being a great year in documentaries, you have Callum mentioning Leviathan, a film Josh has been very vociferous.
He should have stuck with his instinct there.
In his defense and praise of, and Her, the movie from Spike Jonze, and Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street is a movie that has come on late and has gotten a lot of attention from critics. So we'll see if Scorsese makes an appearance here on our list as we get back to the countdown. Michael, your number 7 movie of 2013.
The one most people will not have known, Post Tenebras Lux, directed by Carlos Regattas. It's about it was the craziest thing I saw that showed in Chicago last year, but it's also been kicking around a year or more beyond that on the festival circuit. But mm-hmm. It's about a rural Mexican family man whose life basically falls apart memorably in what I think so much cinema that tries to be dreamlike just looks clunky and movie-like. And this really did flow with the logic and the hallucinatory quality of a dream. And right to the end, when somebody in utter agonizing frustration tears his own head off. And that that is still one of the shots of the year. I mean the way the fact that it was the camera's placed in this perfect sort of middle distance shot where you're getting as much landscape as this astonishing sight, which you know, was clearly sort of like probably a $40 special effect. But it's just the whole movie is just audacious, and it really stuck with me.
It also has a lot. It's something in common with This Is the End in terms of a demon, a visitation
yes,
by a demon.
There's a demon.
But I'm a big fan of this movie as good, well. And good. I also think that Regattas now has 2 of the best opening shots between this
and Silent Light, the last
few years. The opening shot of this, which has his own daughter in the middle of a field being kind of, you know, with all of these sort of animals running around her, and it's, you know, turning dusk, and it's just an amazing shot. You don't know how he
did it. Well, the talk of demons, I mean, dreamlike, is it's more nightmarish. Yeah. And I think maybe that's why it does seem to capture, I mean, our nightmares are different than our dreams, I think, our positive dreams. Mm-hmm. And this is, there's a malevolent spirit over this whole film.
Yeah.
It's a one-timer. I mean, it's really a rough go. At least I found it to be.
You're not revisiting.
I'm glad I saw it. But yeah.
I've seen it twice.
Third time for me, actually.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's why you guys are the experts here on the show, and you are masochists. Let's hear your number 7 pick, Scott.
I'm bracing for Michael's response here because I think I got a little bit of it earlier, but my number 7 is The Wolf of Wall Street by an obscure filmmaker named Martin Scorsese.
An up-and-comer.
And I think that the film is connected so much in my mind to Casino, which is another film I liked. It is about systems at work. I think the comparison between Las Vegas and Wall Street are the same. It's about these outsiders to the system who are thieves, but there are legitimate thieves as well. And why is one different than the other? I think that is kind of at the heart of both movies. And it's a story that's been told before on screen. The story of Stratton Oakmont was told in a film called Boiler Room, which I liked. But Boiler Room was sort of a moral tale. And Scorsese kind of throws that out. That's not really his interest.
You
his
think
interest
he throws
is,
it out. Well, I
well, I mean, it's a, to a degree, but I think it's much more about hypocrisy and much more a condemnation of the system in general. And I think it's just a whale of a tale. Like, it's just full of just scene after scene of just, you know, the book is like this too, just full of just wild anecdotes that, that Scorsese renders with a great deal of style and fun.
You made $72,000 in 1 month.
Yeah.
I tell you what. You show me a pay stub for $72,000 on it, I quit my job right now and I work for you. Hey, Paulie, what's up? No, yeah, no, everything's fine. Hey, listen, I quit.
I mean, this is to me is the best comedy of the year on top of everything else. So yeah. I really enjoyed
it. I found it to be such a chore. And I think it's because it was a comedy. I mean, it just kept hitting. You said it yourself. It's these repeated scenes where we get the joke of seeing these guys, you know, just live in this debauchery. And we're not supposed to be laughing at them. It doesn't moralize at them, except that it also has this thread with the Kyle Chandler character of the feds always in the background, threatening to bring the hammer down. I mean, it's like a Hays Code movie. In a lot of ways, with that coming about, and at 3 hours long, I mean, wow, that the length would be fine if it wasn't the consistent, repeated scene going for the same gag over and over. Huh. That's how it felt to me.
Well, I'm going to abstain from this conversation because I think we're going to talk about The Wolf of Wall Street in a little bit more detail in an upcoming show. So I'm just going to sit here like Switzerland and pretend I don't care about The Wolf of Wall Street at all. We will get into that. I'll say this about the comparison to Boiler Room. There are a lot of bodily fluids in The Wolf of Wall Street, but we never see anyone just go all out, just sobbing phlegm like Giovanni Ribisi in Boiler Room.
Oh, nobody can do that like him. No.
So, Scott, your pick there, The Wolf of Wall Street, number 7. Josh, what do you have? A less moralistic tale?
Well, we finally diverged, Scott, in a big way there. I'm going to go back to when we were in agreement, and that's with Nebraska, my number 7. My love really increases for this film every day. We reviewed it within an hour of seeing it, Adam, and we were both positive but still feeling our way through it. And it's just – it might end up being my favorite Alexander Payne movie when all is said and done. The things you said about that balance, I think it's a balance sometimes he does struggle with between the comedy and the tragedy, and I think it's really well handled here. Bruce Dern is just shattering in this portrayal. I just continually love how you can't quite tell if his doddering is really because he's suffering from dementia or if it's this wily form of self-defense. You're kind of always trying to figure that out. And really, that character is one I keep coming back to. Dignity can be very hard to find in any Payne film, and I think that is the needle in the haystack that Woody is going after in this movie. And it was just such a joy to watch him find it, even though I could see that meant this really bleak film was going to have somewhat of a happy ending. And sometimes, often, I don't like when movies do that. In this case, I was just fine with it.
How did you and Mom end up getting married?
She wanted to.
You didn't?
I figured what the hell.
Were you ever sorry you married her?
All the time. Could have been worse.
Well, you must have been in love. At least at first.
Never came up.
Did you ever talk about having kids? Like how many you wanted and stuff like that?
Nope.
And why did you have us?
Because I like to screw. And your mother's a Catholic, so you figure it out.
Nebraska, a great pick, is a movie that didn't quite make my list, but one I considered. My number 7 film of the year was my number 3 surprise of the year last week on the show when we shared that top 5, and it's the movie Enough Said. And if you guys had asked me what was more likely to happen first, me finding time to watch The Hobbit 2, The Desolation of Smaug, or a Nicole Holofcener film ever making one of my top 10 lists, I would have said, put your money on me watching The Desolation of Smaug. And it isn't necessarily because I've never really enjoyed her work or that I dislike her work that much. It's just really I've never been completely won over by it. And Enough Said comes along, and I just had a smile on my face throughout the entire movie. And it's about Julie Louis-Dreyfus's character. She's a divorcee and has a daughter who's about to go off to college, and she's dealing with that stress. And she meets a similar character in James Gandolfini's Albert, and they do strike up an unlikely romantic relationship. And you hear that phrase a lot. I've probably used it about just enjoying spending time with characters on screen. I enjoyed being with these characters in every moment, and it helps, of course, when they're played as well as they are by Louis-Dreyfus and Gandolfini. They're such good talkers. They play off each other so well, and there's a key scene in this movie. It's their first big date scene in the film. It's one we've seen a million times, that conversation. How is it going to go? Are they going to have chemistry? Are they going to have a terrible time, or are they going to make some kind of connection? And the whole scene is just a treat to watch. It's honest and it's funny, and clearly you do see that connection that's going to carry them through the whole film.
We should all just put a sign on our necks and write down what's wrong with us and get it all out there.
Oh, that's a good idea. What would your sign say?
I don't know. I'm a slob. I have ear hair.
You know there are things you can do to get rid of ear hair.
Researched, taken care of.
So you're a slob, huh?
Not like a dirty hoarder slob.
Uh-huh. What kind?
Like a normal, disorganized woman.
Does your daughter live with you?
Half the time. It aggravates her sometimes, but the thing is she and her mother are very, very neat.
Oh.
As a matter of fact, their favorite store is that, I don't know, what is it? It's the store with all the empty boxes in the storage.
Oh, the container store?
Yes. Yes, the container store. The store that sells crap, so you can put your crap in so you can go out and buy some more crap.
So maybe because of my feelings about Hollifsener's work, I was a little skeptical about the film up until that scene. I hadn't fully bought in, and maybe that little clip doesn't do it full justice, but the fact is, after that dinner scene, I was completely on board, and I didn't care after that first date if they ever got together. They never got together. They did finally get together and make each other miserable. Didn't matter. I just wanted to see where they went. And those two key performances are among my favorites of the year.
You know, though, I will say your description actually leaves out my problem with the movie, which is the Catherine Keener character.
Sure.
And the plot that kind of, I think, really hurts the film, because the scene you describe, I mean, there are moments in this film, and I really do love Hollifsener in general, but there are moments in this film where it's just like, that is as good as it gets in terms of the writing and the performances of those two. But then it's kind of the, you know, like a parasite, this little...
it's a contrivance.
It is. And it leads it to a couple of sitcom-y moments that just felt really...
Yeah, it's a whopper.
They could feel that way, but if you're so bought in as I was, it didn't feel that bad to me. I didn't like that character overall. There's something about that whole performance from Catherine Keener. It's a little too hippy-dippy, you know, poetry goddess for my taste. But at the same time, I felt like it earned it. I felt like it paid off in that moment.
Well,
it didn't
I'll also admit
me.
It's a contrivance, but say that it works to deepen the implications and the decisions that are going to be made. So when it first happens, you're a little bit like, ah, oh, come on. But
you knew
the movie earns and gets you past that pretty quickly. At least it did for me.
Okay. Well, that brings us to our number six picks for Film of the Year. Michael.
My number six is American Hustle, the David O. Russell film, which is in theaters this week here in Chicago. It's already opened in New York and L.A., and there's this weird little debate going on about American Hustle versus The Wolf of Wall Street.
Fosse versus Scorsese.
There's nothing faux about America. I think actually the Fosse, what is the word?
Fosse.
Yeah, the Fosse is actually Wolf of Wall Street. But
I would completely agree with that.
Oh, that's terrible.
All right, that's fine.
Goodfellas.
I'm with you, Scott.
Wow.
I'm with you.
Wow.
No, that's fine.
Please.
That's fine. I mean,
proceed.
All right. I think we can probably agree, though, the personalities of these two films and these two directors is actually very different. I mean, there's a lot of surface resemblance and some of the camera work a little bit. You know, in what Russell does. But really, he's one of the few directors, among other things, I love his sense of humor. I love the fact that he can actually keep 7, 8, 9 plot lines, you know, barely coherent, but juggled in a way that really, really kind of bring the actors to life. And I think if you want to learn something about Abscam, the FBI sting operation from the 1970s, the film's actually based on, this isn't really the movie to see it, because Russell doesn't even care about that. He's just trying to, all the invented stuff, this romantic triangle, it's really more of a quadrangle, that really just kind of gives full rein to Christian Bale and Jennifer Lawrence and Amy Adams and Bradley Cooper. That's the heart of the film. And I just think it's just pure exuberance. I'm a big fan.
Oh! Oh!
Another fire!
No, Danny, not that one. That one's empty. We gotta use the big one.
I told you not to put metal in the science oven. What'd you do that for?
Don't make such a big deal. Just get another one.
I don't want another one. I want the one that Carmine gave me.
Oh, Carmine. I want the one that Carmine gave me. Carmine.
Why don't you just marry Carmine? Get a little gold microwave and put it on a chain around your neck. You want to be more like Carmine? Why don't you build something like he does? Instead of all your empty deals, it's just like your science oven. You know, I read that it takes all of the nutrition out of our food. It's empty, just like your deals. Empty, empty. It's not bull. I read it in an article. Look, by Paul Berdour. Bring something into this house that's going to take all the nutrition out of our food and then light our house on fire? Thank God for me.
This is all about the performances, and I'm surprised that it is being written off. I don't rate it quite as highly as you, Michael, but watching, I don't think I had more fun with performances this year than in this film.
Yeah.
And Bale isn't someone we've talked about in the show, Adam, that I'm usually over the moon about, but he won me over in a big way with this picture. Just this sort of melancholy guy who's going about these scams, and it's about so much more than the weight he gained and the wig he wears. I mean, this movie is also being written off for all the hair pieces that it features, because that's pretty much all the commercials play up.
Right.
But man, do the actors dig into it more than that.
I mean, it's hardly been written off. I mean, in fact, it won Best Picture from the New York Film Critics. It's doing quite well critically overall, as if consensus means anything. But I just think it's inevitably, you have to kind of look at those two films kind of as bookends in a way, just because they're kind of after a similar, you know, milieu of sleaze and corruption a little bit. And there's something about Wolf of Wall Street that just I found, like, after 1 hour, I just thought, I have been down this road before with this director. And with Russell, I didn't feel that way with American Hustle. Yeah, Scorsese's only made 36 more movies than he has. But I just think you can hardly diagram the plot in American Hustle, because that is not Russell's concern. But to me, it's like the plot Nazis can go, you know, watch some other movie if they want.
Well, it's a plotty film though, so I think it probably would have helped if it were more coherent. But I will say the film's defense, because I am being a little bit glib
and
about
it's going to be a stirring defense.
The whole Fossese thing is that I was gratified by how much of a David O. Russell film it is. It has that thing he does, which I kind of think of as a neurotic screwball.
Yeah.
And I like the way that kind of was played into this kind of genre fair. So, it's a film I like, but it's pretty far from loving it.
Scott, your number six?
My number six is Blue is the Warmest Color, which won the Palme d'Or and then was subject to all kinds of crazy talk. And I always feel like the controversy that's – the many controversies that have sort of built up around this film almost feel right for it. I mean, it feels like, you know, we live at a time when foreign language films especially, and independent films as well, there's stuff to put in the pipeline. You know, they're just – it's just product. They come in a week. They go on streaming and that's it. This was an actual event. This is a 3-hour movie that took a very intimate story and made it just huge and epic in a way that only the director Kashish can do. And it's got an extraordinary lead performance by an actress whose name I still haven't quite figured out how to say, so I'm not going to. But, you know, the film was originally in French called The Life of Adele, Part 1 and Part 2. And the film actually really gives you this one character and shows you everything, not just this coming of age story about this love affair, which is quite emotional, but also about her interests, her profession, just everything. And it's just full of life. I absolutely adore this movie.
Yeah, I like how you put that, because thinking back on it, there isn't an aspect of Adele's life that you feel like you haven't seen, really. Mm-hmm. And it does encompass all of that. Yeah.
Including why those sex scenes are necessary and a great aspect of that film, ultimately.
And a great aspect. I think some of the sex scenes are far weaker than the others, but we covered that.
My.
So now we're dissecting sex scenes here on Film Spotting. I think that's another podcast,
we
actually.
We have to know everything about this character.
That's what I'm saying.
Yep.
Well, and really, who better than four heterosexual white males
exactly.
to sit around?
Yeah.
Also,
the debate over this film has actually been pretty brutal to be around, but I do love the movie very much.
Well, look at you. You're just always stifling conversation,
I know,
Scott.
Sorry. I'll stop.
Josh, your number six.
My number six is The Wind Rises, a biopic from legendary animator Hayao Miyazaki. And it envisions the life, but mostly the work, really, of Jiro Horikoshi, who designed the Zero Fighter from World War II that Japan used. It may seem like an odd subject, but probably only if you think of animation as a place where you're not going to be able to find nuance or complexity, because this movie has so much of that. It has the beauty you would expect from Miyazaki, and we often expect from animation, but there's so much more going on here, too. I really found it, you know, people have kind of reacted to this subject matter, at least stateside, how do we receive a movie about this, you know, about a vital weapon used against the country? And I think that's a question that The Wind Rises itself really considers and is largely about. I mean, it's celebratory of this man's talent, but also mournful of where it may have led. And it's really consideration of talent corrupted. I think one of the lines that I liked in there is a character talks about Cursed Dreams, and it's a movie that really captures that.
Hmm. That is the last movie I watched in preparation for this list and didn't make my top 10, but as it was going on, we end up seeing more of a romantic tale. There mm-hmm. is a love story that yep. blossoms out of it. In the last 20 minutes or so of that movie, I found myself getting a little dusty there and
oh, sure.
in my living room as I was watching it on the couch thinking, what happened with this film? It really is pretty devastating in parts, and I'm not surprised at all to see it there on your list. My number six is a movie that, Scott, I think you had it in your top 10, The Act of Killing.
Mm-hmm.
You number mentioned nine. Previously the documentary about former Indonesian death squad leaders who reenact their real life killings in all these genres. They basically get to perform for the camera. And you know, Josh, it wouldn't be my top 10 list of the year if I didn't find a space for a movie about making a movie. I had to make that happen. And I did here with
this
The
counts.
Act of Killing. Though this one, it's truly unique. It's a movie that you've got Joshua Oppenheimer, the director. He's making this film about these former death squad leaders. And they're making this film, of course, of these reenactments of their atrocities. And you think, as you're watching it, how could they be doing this? How can they be celebrating it? How can they be exposing themselves in this way, these crimes that they committed? And of course, that's the whole point. They're free. They're unashamed. They're celebrated for it. And they love movies so much that seeing their acts brought to life is something that they see as a triumph. They see it as totally justified and only a good thing. But something during our discussion we talked about, I said, to echo what you said earlier, Scott, in this show, I think it strikes a blow for the ecstatic truth. As mm-hmm. Herzog puts it, mm-hmm. it isn't about facts. It isn't about capturing life with a supposed clear subjective point of view, or objective point of view, I should say, which is impossible anyway. It really is about capturing their truth as these characters reveal it. I think it's so much more potent and revealing to see someone like this main character, Anwar, that he follows, as he sees himself on screen. The way he portrays himself is really so much more revealing ultimately. And I'm with you, Scott, that I don't think any film I've seen, certainly this year, but maybe in recent years, has made me more uncomfortable and horrified at times watching it. I think that there are so many scenes, and we're going to do at our end of year wrap party our favorite scenes of the year. I could probably pick a top five just from The Act of Killing. Mm. One that stands out to me, though, is the scene where they're on some kind of TV soundstage. They've got this gang of killers sitting around. I can't remember exactly what they're doing in that context, but someone else comes in, an outsider, and he starts telling a story, and he's trying to ingratiate himself. He's trying to make himself part of the gang, and he starts telling a story. And as it goes on, you realize that the story he's telling is the tale of his grandfather being taken out in the middle of the night, not by these men, but by men just like him, as I recall, and being murdered. And you get that laughter that then turns into uncomfortable laughter, and then it becomes silence. I mean, it's a scene that just showing human folly that I don't think Shakespeare could have topped, frankly, as you watch that whole conversation play out. It's just harrowing, harrowing stuff, and that's the tip of the iceberg with this film, The Act of Killing.
How about Aeschylus? Could he have topped it?
Aeschylus, perhaps, okay. And I'm a big fan of Aeschylus' work as well, so thank
you,
Michael.
I like this film a lot. I just saw it myself. It didn't quite make... I mean, for a while, I really did struggle with this idea of as the film acknowledges up front, this completely invented premise that, you know, we are going to kind of establish the rules for this documentary. You know, we are going to have these guys, you know, we're bringing this idea to these people and to see if they will kind of jump on board and make this sort of, you know, this movie about the worst of, you know, the slaughter of all these Chinese communists and everybody else, you know, thousands and thousands of people back in the 60s. And for a while, I kind of struggled with the kind of patent artificiality of it, and then you start getting scenes like when you hear about the main character Anwar's, you know, what is really plaguing him at night when he can't sleep, and it's not just a matter of a simple kind of comeuppance for the guy or something like that, but it really does get you in a place where you're just thinking about the banal, you know, the yeah. old phrase, the banality of evil, and that,
right.
that's also kind of the thing that sticks with you with 12 Years a Slave, I think, because it's not so much about the unspeakable, awful, brutal horrors that are endured. It's more just this miserable everyday quality of what these people have mm-hmm. would do and what they've done and what they've done to other people. Yeah.
Well, that is part one of our top 10 films of 2013 countdown. Send us your picks for your favorite films of the year or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and @facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in limited release, opening in Chicago this weekend, Faust, it is the 2011 2011 winner of the top prize at the Venice Film Festival, and you heard Peter Labuza name it his number one film of the year. We also have Following the Ninth in the Footsteps of Beethoven's Final Symphony, a documentary about four lives transformed by that famous work, and Some Velvet Morning. It's a movie written and directed by Neil LaBute with Stanley Tucci. Out in wide release, Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues, Walking with Dinosaurs, American Hustle, you just heard Michael share it there, is his number six film of the year, and Inside Llewyn Davis, the latest film from the Coen brothers, which might just make another appearance or two next week here on Film Spotting as we get to part two of our top 10 films of the year countdown. Michael and Scott will be here. We are chaining them to the radiator here at WBEZ.
We're keeping them for a week, right?
Exactly.
All right. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music this week came from some of the best scores of 2013. It was curated by Sam Smith. You can see some of his design work at samsmith.net.
Of course, we have to thank Scott Tobias and Michael Phillips as well. Guys, why don't you share with our listeners where they can find your work?
ChicagoTribune.com/movies.
Easy enough, Scott.
TheDissolve.com.
Great to have you here as always, and look forward to your top five picks.
For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
I just wonder, have you ever heard the word abutment before? Is it an abutment?
It probably is in Canada.